Welcome to Independent Curriculum, the podcast. Independent Curriculum highlights the ideas, organizations, schools, and individuals playing important roles in shaping the future of education. I'm Peter Gao, Executive Director of the Independent Curriculum Group, a global consortium of over 140 schools interested in building stronger, more effective academic programs that meet the needs of their own students in alignment with each school's unique mission and values. You can learn more about us by visiting our website at independentcurriculum.org. In this episode of Independent Curriculum, the podcast, we continue our interview with John Gulla, Executive Director of the E.E. Ford Foundation, an organization renowned for its support of independent schools and some of their most innovative and impactful initiatives. John is a former teacher and school head, and in his position at the E.E. Ford Foundation, he is an important voice for the future of education. We are grateful for his willingness to be with us, and I am delighted to continue our conversation begun in part one, our very first Independent Curriculum podcast. Well, I'd like to circle back to some of those funding areas in a minute. A couple of sort of more general questions, and this is sort of my soapbox moment, I guess. I'd maintain that independent schools, despite their collective brand becoming ever more shiny and desirable, have, at least in the years of my career, and I think yours, been playing a sort of decreasingly active role in the national conversation on teaching and learning. And I'm wondering if you agree with this, and if so, you know, do you see a way to harness or to refocus the both the brand power and I think the capacities of the independent school sector and helping our schools become more effective in working for the good of education and for kids in general?
Well, let me start by saying one of the connections that I've made since starting at E.E. Ford that I've appreciated is the chance to begin to get to know you and the work that ICG is doing. And I know how important the public independent school connections are to you personally and to a good number of people associated with Independent Curriculum Group. One of the reasons I mentioned early on about my family background is that I've never had a kind of us-them private versus public. I've been much more interested in people who were interested in education and children, and hoped that people would find the way to pursue their own professional interests in a school and in a type of school that would work best for them. I agree with some of what you'd said and disagree with some others. That is, I do think that independent schools have sometimes let me talk not about their full history, just their sort of modern post-Second World War history, have been perhaps not as engaged in advancing the profession of education broadly as they might be. But I do think there are elements, if you examine the full history of independent schools, the willingness of independent schools to really struggle with issues of pluralism, of diversity, of wanting to open. Independent schools were, for the most part, all single sex. They were white, they were rich, they were Christian. That the earliest waves of diversity had to do with religion, and then race, and the tumultuous period of the 60s and early 70s with co-education, with a number of boards who felt that the schools they cared deeply about would cease to be of interest to people if they did not become co-educational, and then a significant number that of single-sex schools that merged then. And I think incorrectly people didn't think there would still be a market for single-sex schools, but there is. But I do think that there are areas where I think independent schools haven't partnered as actively with their public school peers. But I do think that there are areas where it is going on, maybe more in more isolated a way than it could or should. But in terms of pedagogy, of how we teach and the art of teaching, and areas of cultural competencies and some of the ways in which there are ironies to this, that the independent school world could be credited with the creation of, for example, the AP program, just as I think now that the independent school world is leading education away from it, just as many public schools are concentrating more on some of the standardized measures at the very time in which I think many independent schools are recognizing the limitations and problems with that as a tool of measuring student progress and assessing their strengths. I think there are ways in which independent schools ought to share more, as I think independent schools could learn. I think there are things going on in public schools that the independent schools are sadly mistaken if they fail to realize that there are things they could learn from the public school down the street. And I know those are conversations that you personally have tried to promote and that I think would benefit us all.
Thank you. Yeah, I like to think that there are things that we could learn from our public school brothers and sisters and vice versa. I think there's a lot of potential there. And I think you're right. I do see that in some ways independent schools have been maybe bellwethers or canaries in the mine shaft around issues like advanced placement and especially, I think, pluralism and inclusivity, multicultural education, whatever you might wish to call it. I think our schools have been leaders. I'm not sure that we've done enough to let the rest of the world know how and why schools are leading in these directions. I think my personal thought on this is that in the era of No Child Left Behind, public school systems of all kinds and all qualities have had this tremendous distraction of standardized testing and standardized test preparation that has prevented them in many cases from pursuing initiatives in whether it's technology or global competency, whatever it might be. I think that's been an area where independent schools have had a leg up and perhaps have not realized it and have not learned how to share and even leverage that. So it'll be fun to see what happens as I think more and more schools, and much of it through the work of or through the work that's promoted by the E.E. Ford Foundation, become more engaged in this kind of thing. To sort of circle back to the work, maybe I'll come back. I've got some thoughts on the independent curriculum group and sort of where we are relative to where you are. But in the context of the state of education today, I'm sort of thinking about, and you've touched on some of this, what sorts of things make proposals that come across your desk and become part of your agenda, the E. Ford's agenda? What makes those proposals, some of them more compelling than others?
Sure, it's a good question. It's one I often hear from school heads.
I dare say it's rather general, but yeah.
Right, it's a little bit like the question from the student or her or his parents to the admission director, like, what does the school look for? And you know, there's no simplistic answer to that, but I'll try to sketch out a little of what I think tends to be the pattern, the shape of what I see happening at E. Ford. The proposals that the foundation board tends to fund, I think, on the whole, are proposals that make sense to the board in the context of the school that's actually making the proposal. So I think what happens at E. Ford is that with help from me and the time that I spend with the school head, and I visit the campus of every school that makes a proposal. I am there, feet on the ground, for the best part of a day. Mm. And I visit classes, and I talk to teachers, and I talk to students, and I talk to administrators, and I try to get the sense. It's not a complete, it's not a perfect sense. But it's beyond poking around on the website or analyzing the quantitative data or limiting myself to the conversation with the school head, but actually in the community for a day, trying to get a sense, and then that provides a recommendation to the board. And I think what the board tries to do is it begins by trying to get a sense of what is this school like. Now, there are schools that have literally had a dozen successful proposals to E. Ford. So there are some schools that the board knows quite well, and there are some members of the board who have been on the E. Ford board for decades. So there's some cases where they already know the school quite well. But then there are other proposals that come to us from a school for the first time. But I think, generally speaking, that the board tries to know that school and then to evaluate that proposal in the context of that school. So let me, again, sort of explain a little bit by example. There have been recent successful proposals that E. Ford has made to Sidwell Friends and to the Latin School of Chicago, to Bosque and Cape Fear Academy, all for what would generally be seen as financial aid proposals. But the Sidwell and Latin School of Chicago financial aid proposals were quite a bit different than Bosque or Cape Fear Academies. Though all were about financial aid and all were successful, they really made sense because the school made a proposal that to the board at least seemed to make sense given where it was in its life. There are schools that have a variety of different challenges. So to take an absurd example, I mean, a school that really is struggling to attract and pay its faculty might not be seen as a school that should be making a proposal for a marble floor of its lobby of entrance of a new building. The board would want to say, yeah, if we were at that school, if we recognized what our strengths were, what our challenges were, where we were in the history of this institution, is this a proposal that we think makes some sense for that school?
Well, that makes good sense. And I see that they would have to be individual. And I'm glad and delighted to hear the emphasis on school culture, because I think what you said earlier about culture eating strategy is absolutely true. I'm thinking about areas too where schools are probably asking these days for a bunch of money for different kinds of things, but all sort of under the umbrella of technology. Are there ways that some schools are using technology that are going to be more interesting to the E. Ford board than buying, I don't know, laptops for everyone? Or is that, again, depends on context, I suppose.
It's a good follow-up question to the earlier one, and I'd say the answer is somewhat similar. It will sort of depend on that school and its history. So a school that modestly financed school in a part of the country where independent schools don't have a long tradition, where there are some questions about the strength of future demand for enrollment, and where there just hasn't been much of an investment, but where the school truly believes that it's not serving its students well because it hasn't been able to keep pace with the purchase of the tools of technology or providing the professional development and access of those tools to the faculty. Certainly that's going to be a more compelling case perhaps for the board than a school with considerable resources that simply comes to us asking us to help them buy stuff. I mean, if it is, again, this is sort of overly generalized, but if a proposal that simply has a long shopping list of 3D printers and laser cutters and other equipment for a fabrication lab or for their maker space, might not be viewed with as much enthusiasm as a proposal that might have some of that, but also integrates aspects of professional development, or that has some partnership with a local university, or I think of a school that had a partnership with a local fabrication lab, where they, or I think of St. Martin's in the outside of New Orleans that they wanted to take their makerspace on the road. So their proposal was for a spark truck, where rather than the equipment sitting in the innovation lab, which they had, they wanted another set of equipment they wanted in the back of a vehicle, so they could partner with organizations throughout New Orleans doing some of that kind of prototyping with community partners, but where they didn't have to invite those partners to school but could bring the equipment to them. So the foundation certainly will say yes to proposals that are simply buying technology. I mentioned earlier some of the virtual reality, mm-hmm. and schools that are experimenting with that, and then how it's not just bells and whistles, but fundamentally deepening the engagement that some students can have with anatomy and physiology, or geology, or to some extent history. And anybody who's sort of begun to play with that, whether the high end Oculus Rift or the lower end Google Cardboard, not for all kids, and not in ways that they're going to totally transform all aspects of education, but will this become, in my humble opinion, a bigger part of what we do? I think yes is the answer to that.
So you have not yet seen a proposal related to Pokemon Go, though, is that
correct? No, I have not.
I'm interested because what I'm hearing is sort of a double thrust. And one is that the foundation and the board and you are really looking for opportunities to help schools transform themselves or transform some important area of their practice or culture. And I'm also hearing a look for or search for opportunities to support schools that are doing things that are truly innovative. Is that a fair characterization?
It is. It is very much a fair characterization. I would also add to that. One of the questions that I find I answer often to people who I've known through the 3.5 decades of work in independent schools, with I might be in casual conversation and I might be going to visit School X, which our colleagues might know to be a particularly well-financed school, and they'll say, well, why do they need E. Ford's money? And the foundation is committed to good ideas. And there are times in which I think the board is very enthusiastic in its support for a modestly financed school, where our grant, whether that is a $50,000 grant or a $250,000 grant, means the world to them, that it can truly be transformational, at least in terms of some particular program that they're pursuing. For a good number of schools, one of the great benefits of E. E. Ford is the equivalent of the independent school good housekeeping stamp of approval and imprimatur of the foundation, that they will, schools, some of the most thoughtful and wisest schools will come to the foundation, and if we say yes to their proposal, we'll really leverage our support for their proposal within their community to say, hey, here's this foundation, this national foundation that really does know independent schools. They've been making grants for 60 years, and they have found us worthy. And it's a way of generating some independent, objective corroboration in the community that, of course, school expects that its own parents and alumni will love it. But here's a chance for them to say, but here's this other more objective entity that has found our proposal worthy of funding. And they might use that grant to leverage philanthropic support from a component of their constituency where they have it. So there's certainly that also happens. But the notion that it's not just need, it's also the merit of the idea, mm-hmm. And the the founding notion, which was to assist independent schools to do things that they may not be able to do without the foundation's help.
I'm sort of wondering, as a follow-up on that, and without naming names, of course, I'm sort of wondering whether there have been situations in which the foundation has been willing to fund a proposal that, in fact, the school's own community has not found worthy of support. Is that I would assume that's a rare thing, perhaps a never happened thing.
No, it certainly has happened. I mean, it is rare, fortunately, and I think that that's partly a reflection of the way in which we engage with the schools. But not every school successfully raises the full match. We'll prorate the grant. So a school that as I mentioned earlier, I try very much in the work I do with school heads to have them not overreach. The board views favorably a school, particularly a school with considerable capacity, that will come to us with a 1-2, a 1-3, 1-4, et cetera, match. And all of the things being equal, a school that's trying to stretch and leverage our philanthropy in that way gets a more positive response from us. But there have been schools that have failed to fully raise the match. I think everybody's raised some. Nobody's been shut out. And then we will prorate the grant. But I'd say that in my now 3+ years, that's under 5%, maybe closer to 2 or 3%, and I'd say we're talking in terms of total funding, less than 1% of the funding. Is in part schools recognize that it won't necessarily serve them well in future proposals to the foundation if there is that blemish that they had come to us. But sometimes there were reasons. I mean, you could well understand back in 2008-09, there were schools that did not have the crystal ball to predict some of what was about to happen to the world financially. But there have been schools that struggled. They were in the midst of some other campaign. They also came to us, and they ended up prioritizing their own fundraising within their community to be sure that they could build that lower school building or that arts center. And this E.E. Ford project didn't receive the emphasis or the attention that it may have. But I think I could list on the fingers of one and maybe one and a half hands the schools out of the those that I've worked with in 3+ years that haven't fully made the match.
In a sort of related question, I guess, and maybe this puts you on the spot a little bit, are there proposals that when you hear about them, you just kind of sigh and think, oh, some people just aren't getting it?
Yes, that's the answer. And I certainly will mention no names here, but I will describe that. So I'll give you an example. I mean, I don't think it is the sweet spot for E.E. Ford. For a school that is undertaking a ambitious capital campaign and that has antiquated facilities that do not support the science program, for example, that they want to provide their students. And they're in the midst of raising money for what will be a $5 or $7 million science building, to come to us for a $50,000 grant in the traditional grants that we have made, or even in this new version, $100,000, that might represent 1% of the total cost, and to simply come and say we would like E. Ford to consider a $50,000 or $100,000 grant for this $5 million or $7 million project, that is unlikely to win support for the board, because they will say, do they really need our 1% contribution? Mm-hmm. Now, the way in which I think more thoughtful school heads will utilize E.E. Ford is, I'll use that same example. So imagine a school that is building a new science building. And the science department chair and some of the faculty and the head were really keen on having a green roof on the building. and that was going to bring additional expense. But they wanted to integrate the roof into the curriculum. They wanted to be able to have some environmental sustainability elements, to have features of that green roof that could help students have some idea about emerging areas of LEED architecture, things of that sort. But as we all know, what happens in a building project is that you identify a general scope and approximate budget. Then you get into it, and the general contractor comes in with their first estimate, and lo and behold, what you thought was a $5 million is a $6.5 million building. And you've got to, quote, value engineer, unquote, out of that project all kinds of components to shoehorn it back into the budget. There have been schools that have used EE Ford to protect some component of that larger project from being edited out on the editing room floor, to be value engineered out, because the timing has been such that they've come to us, we have approved that particular component of the project, some sort of compartmentalized self-independent component of the project, green roof on the science building. And then if they want to value engineer that up, of course the school can still do that, but then they're going to send us back the money, and no school really wants to do that. Mm-hmm. There was a school that had a number of physically disabled students, and there was a big project, but they wanted, and they were not going to be required under ADA, and it was not going to meet the reasonable accommodation test, but they wanted to put an elevator in the building so that their students who were in wheelchairs could have access to the full building. That was a very sympathetic response on the part of the board that saw that, even though it was the same sort of deal, it was, and we're looking for money for an elevator for in a much larger building project. Schools that have wanted to there was Wheeler School in Providence, Rhode Island, that had a big performing arts project, but they wanted, they came to us with a proposal so that they could add elements to the design that would more easily allow them to open up that facility to the Providence community. They wanted both a box office and some design elements, security doors and ways in which they could wall off the rest of the school but open up just the performing arts in the same sort of way. The EE Ford board was enthusiastic and in support of that.
I'm thinking about all of this and thinking about the kinds of things that you're describing, which are, again, both transformative and very much culture-based, the elevator project or the theater project. And I'm thinking about this. I see an alignment between the work that the independent curriculum group is trying to do as sort of a newly formed and still, I think, hopefully born but not fully developed community of schools, a working network of schools and educators, and also a voice for a particular approach to curriculum, which is really based on helping schools develop their own capacities to create academic programs, learning experiences that are going to serve the kids that are actually in those schools. I'm sort of thinking about how you see the work that the EE Ford Foundation is doing, and you've touched on some of this, might be made even more relevant to the larger education conversation, because I know that the Independent Curriculum Group can learn from the examples of the EE Ford Foundation, but also from some of the collaborations that have been supported through the leadership grants and the large collaborative grant that you're mm-hmm. anticipating.
The direction, strategic direction, and ultimate distribution of the assets of the Ford Foundation are the province of the advisory board. But I don't mind saying that I've been interested in conversations with the board to try to figure out ways where we can, with some, not necessarily all, but some of the grants that we make and some of the areas where we choose to emphasize our grant making, to promote that collective thinking, those sort of partnerships, bringing schools together. I think that independent schools haven't historically been as interconnected as they might be. And let me give you just a couple of examples. So Lawrenceville, a school that could be argued didn't really need E. Ford's money, but on behalf of the 8 School Association came with a proposal for a web-based tool they called ProtoStar to help schools, the 8 School Association is where it began, measure their progress toward meeting environmental sustainability goals. So many schools, particularly boarding schools, that were working on energy conservation or decreasing the waste that they produced or other elements of a plan that the school had created to try to become more sustainable, didn't have an easy way, though college universities had such a tool, where they had a web-based tool for measuring progress, and they developed that tool. And the 8 School Association, it made sense that Lawrenceville would come, have its peers join in, and that money would come in large part from E.E. Ford, but with all of the schools pitching in terms of the match. Similarly, in the Bay Area, there's this very exciting collaboration going on in what's called Blend Ed, but 5 schools, Athenian, Urban, Marin, Lick-Wilmerding, College Prep, that joined together voluntarily to offer blended courses to their students and sort of take advantage of the scale of having 5 schools that were geographically proximate to one another. And one of them, Athenian, came to us with a grant just for its component of BlendEd. And then as Eric talked to his counterparts at the other 4 schools, they came as a leadership grant, Monique Devane, on behalf of College Prep and the other 4 schools. And just this past April, E. Ford said yes to them. They're building what, in their own words, is a trust economy among the 5 schools. So I think that it's too early for me to say much about the Collaborative Innovation Grant, but there we had a very strong positive response to that opportunity, and I'm sad that we didn't have the ability to entertain even more of those proposals as finalists, but we were going to have only one $2 million grant and wanted to be reasonable in the number of schools that were going to be finalists in consideration for that. But the foundation is quite keen on doing what it can to have schools join together to learn from one another, to forge partnerships and to work in collaboration. As I say, with at least some of our philanthropy, not necessarily all of it. So yes, that's very much a part of what I think we're doing.
Do you kind of see the independent school sector, and I know that the independent curriculum group, we'd like to have more non-independent schools, but for reasons that are not always clear, that's kind of who our organization largely represents. Do you see the independent school sector as headed in a positive direction? I worry sometimes that sometimes we need to save ourselves from some of the factors in the market that are, I think, deleterious, the rising costs, the worry about our schools becoming simply schools for the 1% or the 0.1%. And I think we've all seen examples of schools who have allowed their own kind of sense of themselves to overshadow the idea of the good of education as a whole. Is this sector going in a good direction? And what role do you think the E.E. Ford Foundation can have? I think a very positive one. I assume you think so too. In helping schools transcend their own self-interest and see themselves as being a new set of shining stars on the educational or in the educational mm-hmm. sky.
Yeah, that is a central, a critically important question. I can answer it in a couple of different levels. First, I do think that the E. Ford Foundation, and this is part of the sort of bully pulpit that I guess I have as executive director, is that when I was a school head, I always had to measure any of my public addresses or written communication, trying to see that through the eyes and minds of my constituent group. What would the parents or the faculty or the alumni say? But one of the things that this board has been quite clear in giving me direction to be at times provocative and to ask difficult questions. And there are things that I think the independent school world could wrestle with that would make it better. I don't think on the whole, and I won't go into a long disquisition about it, but I don't think that our whole accreditation process serves us as well as it could. I think there are ways in which that state and regional association accrediting process could end up being a stronger one for improvement of schools. One of the phenomena that I think is at the heart of this is that schools, every school that comes into existence pretty much does so with the expectation that it will be an institution existing in perpetuity. We do have these schools that are 100, 200, 350 years old, and I'm not really aware of many schools that come into being, open up, found, and then start operation, and then say, "Oh, we've run our natural lifespan." The ending of schools is fraught, and what happens, Sweetbriar is just a collegiate example of that, but forces come to the fore when a school is threatened with potential closure, but I think on the whole, alumni and present families don't want that to happen. And so we're set up, the forces are aligned to try to keep schools in existence, even when maybe that's not the wisest thing. It's a tough decision for a board to say, we think we should shut this down. We think that there is no longer a need for this. You can't find many examples of that. I mean, there are some, but there aren't many examples of independent schools where they decided, particularly before they were insolvent, that mm-hmm. there just wasn't a future. Now, there are the schools that shut down because they finally just run out of money. They can't pay the bills, keep the lights on, pay the teachers, and they go bankrupt. This is a gross generalization too, but I guess I'd say that I see three categories of independent schools, and they're not equal in number. But there are independent schools that, by virtue of their resources, their endowment, their active support from their constituencies, their reputation, are insulated. There's no threat to them at all. They're going to continue to exist as far as the eye can see. I see absolutely no reason. The demand for places, and then the wealth they have, the resources, the endowment they have, the annual support that they enjoy, the selectivity in admission, I see them just continuing open-endedly for another 50, 100, 350 years. I think they're fully insulated from any of the threats that exist. I think there's a second category of schools that are challenged, and then you see this, I see this more in some geographic areas than others. So on the whole, New York City schools aren't challenged, or San Francisco schools aren't challenged in the same way that Cleveland schools or Detroit schools or even Philadelphia schools or Baltimore schools are challenged. And some of it may be the historical numbers, that is, that some schools, some geographic areas that just had a richness of many very fine independent schools may not have today a population that can support the independent schools charging the sort of tuitions that they are. And I think in that second category, the for survival, I think there's going to have to be rapid differentiation. I think that schools are going to have to make some choices. And rather than appear to offer essentially the same kind of liberal arts, academic arts, athletics offerings, they're going to have to begin to specialize. They're going to have to become known and take a risk to say, okay, they're going to be a school that's known for its strong, you know, endurance sports program of cross-country skiing and cross-country running and rowing and other things, as well as a sort of an emphasis in their curriculum on global studies or on robotics or whatever. Maybe they may need to be looking at the market demand and say, okay, we're going to try to differentiate ourselves from our peers where we will be able to, in certain markets, be able to attract a sufficient number of families who want what we're offering. Then there's a third category of schools where I think there will be active mergers and there will be schools that are closing. The canary in the coal mine is not NAS schools as much as it is religiously affiliated schools, but there are lots of non-public schools, and I mean listed in hundreds, that since I've joined EU4 have just closed their doors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that will continue. And the competition from both public schools, especially public schools in open enrollment states where it's possible for the dollars to follow a student who may live in community X but go to school in community Y. But charters, for-profits, I think that anybody who's not paying close attention to the explosion of different models of schools fails to see the kind of competition that I think is going to be a part of our future from you know, the alt school kind of model, especially those that are relying on technology to accomplish certain economies of scale and to hit a price point. I think the one of the things that certain for-profit schools have identified is that historically, I think that the way the model has worked is there have been the sort of top tier independent schools that charged X, and that varied, you know, market to market, but that they charged X for tuition. And then the public schools that were funded through property taxes and other tax revenue at a state or local level, you know, people say zero. They don't charge tuition. It's true they're not charging tuition, but they're not free schools, and that there is money paying for those schools. But top level independent schools at X, public schools paid for through taxes, and then the religious schools at about half X. And I think that gap between half X and X is where a lot of the competition is focused. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is one of the things that the SSS calculations and the kind of sacrifice for some of the what most Americans would consider to be wealthy families. But the sacrifices that those wealthy families need to make to pay $35,000 or $40,000 tuitions, what it means in terms of the vacations they can take or the frequency of buying a new car, those are sacrifices they're not going to necessarily make for two or three kids at tuition. But if they find a price point below that, they're not going to qualify for aid at independent schools, but they're not willing to pay what independent schools are charging. That is sort of one phenomenon. So in all of your question was, you know, is there a role for EE4? I hope so. I hope there's a role for the National Association of Independent Schools, or for EE4, for state and regional associations, and for everybody who cares about education to try to ensure that we're providing a variety of different opportunities. This isn't specifically an answer to that question, but one of the things that does concern me and that I worry some about is both the commodification of education and the way in which I see forces coming to bear on the world of education in a parallel way to the forces that generation and a half ago came to bear on the medical profession. I think there are those who look at education and see it as whatever it is, $1.2, $1.3 trillion a year business, and they want to monetize.
Mm.
them. And that concerns me. I know that many people see independent schools as sort of these elite institutions, and in many ways they are. But one of the things that I hope I can do is I'm trying to get some group of schools to come to the foundation with a proposal to study the access that independent schools provide to selective higher ed. About 1% of the students who are graduating from high school going on to four-year college and universities are coming from NAIS schools annually. Ballpark figure, about 1%. Let's say that you and I took the top 50 or 100 colleges and universities as ranked by their own measure of selectivity. And then we said, if your enrollment and the education you received at an NAIS school had no bearing whatsoever, and there was no relationship at all, you might expect that of the students who were matriculating at those top 50 or 100 most selective college universities, about 1% of them would be coming from NAIS schools. But lo and behold, it's higher than that. Big surprise, right? I'm not sure what it is. I'd like to have that data. I can't easily access it. Somebody would need to put the time in. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that it's 30%. That 30% of the matriculating students at the 50 or 100 most selective colleges and universities are coming from NAIS schools. So 30 times what the percentage represented in the whole pool might be. Yeah, do you think that's sort of reasonable?
I think that's very reasonable.
Yeah. Okay. Now, couple that with the following. And when I see this, I mean, everybody who knows independent schools knows that most independent schools make a significant commitment to socioeconomic diversity. Let's again say, ballpark figure, I don't know what it is. Data would need to be gathered, a more accurate number than my best guesstimate. But I think about a third of NAIS students receive financial aid.
Mm-hmm.
So take those two things that I've just set forth and combine them. That would mean that of the 30% of the NAIS students who are in those top 50 or 100 most selective college universities, that you would expect 10% of them to be financial aid recipients, because they represent one-third of the NAIS student body. But I bet if you were able to obtain that data, you would find out that it's much, much higher. That is to say, I think NAIS schools, which, yes, are bastions of privilege, there's no doubt about it, but they are not just that. They are also engines of social mobility, particularly K-12 schools that identify students at kindergarten and who provide financial aid, have a pathway for students to receive not only the kind of education that can allow them to succeed in the hyper-selective admission at a place like Stanford that took only 4.6% of its students last year, and to develop the social capital to be able to endure that kind of experience and be successful at it. So I would love to see us get that data, and I would love that to be known. So we weren't just these ivy-covered, isolated, silver spoon-in-mouth bastions of privilege, but the true community is trying to serve a number of goals that I think we are.
I think that would be an incredibly valuable project, and I wish I could think right offhand of a school that I should say, go talk to John about this, but perhaps I will come across that school. So, John Gulla, I'd like to thank you very much for being with us today on the First Independent Curriculum Podcast, and I look forward to future conversations with you and learning more about what the E.E. Ford Foundation and you are up to.
Thank you, Peter. I've enjoyed it tremendously, and it's been a treat to have spent the last hour and three quarters in conversation with you. So thanks for the invitation.
Well, this ends Independent Curriculum's interview with John Gulla, Executive Director of the E.E. Ford Foundation. This is Peter Gao from the Independent Curriculum Group, thanking you for listening today and looking forward to having you with us for more episodes of Independent Curriculum the podcast.